Okay, thanks, Toby. Okay, so first of all, I want to say that I've taken the organizers' admonitions to heart, and I've prepared very little material for this talk. So that means that, you know, if there's lots of discussion, there'll be time for it, and if there isn't lots of discussion, it'll be a very short talk. That would be okay, too. Now I should explain the title. As you know, right, we're supposed to be meeting to talk about novel numerical methods for various things. And in particular, one of the things that we want to do is to do gravitational collapse in a situation where things are asymptotic to empty de Sitter space. And undoubtedly, in order to do that, we're going to need to construct a bunch of new numerical methods, as we heard this morning from Franz, and as we'll presumably hear later on from Paul Chesler. But what I want to do in this particular talk is to address the question, you know, to what extent and in what cases do we need a bunch of numerical methods, and how much can we get away with using the same old numerical methods that we've used in plain old four-dimensional asymptotically flat GR. Okay, so that's basically the reason for the question mark. And a lot of the stuff I'm going to be talking about is stuff that's been published or about to be published and will appear on the archive in these two papers that I've done with Leo Pandozeis and Dori Reichman. And then towards the end, I'll talk about some work that's in progress. Okay, so here's the basic idea, and since the ground has been prepared beautifully by Toby and by Franz, I'm going to say almost nothing in the way of motivation. Basically, the idea is that there's an ADS-CFT conjecture or correspondence, depending on, you know, which side of the aisle you sit on. And in particular, one of the things that's supposed to be there in that correspondence is that black holes are supposed to correspond to thermal states. So what that means is that in some sense, if we do gravitational collapse and the formation of black holes, that should tell us something about the formation of a thermal state and the coming to equilibrium of a system that didn't start out in equilibrium. Okay. So that's it as far as motivation goes. From now on, for the rest of the talk, I'm just going to treat this as a problem in GR. In other words, for the rest of the talk, I'm going to take the point of view that for some reason, we're interested in doing gravitational collapse, not in the traditional GR setting of asymptotic flatness and four space-time dimensions, but instead in the, from the GR point of view, unusual setting of asymptotically ADS and five space-time dimensions. And, but, you know, nonetheless, it's still a property, it's still a problem in GR. Okay, so now, having said that, the question becomes, you know, what method should we use? And for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to ask the question, to what extent can we get away with the plain old ordinary methods that we use in four dimensions for plain old gravitational collapse and asymptotically flat spacetime? Okay, so let me remind you of one of those methods. In some sense, one of the simplest ones, but also quite effective. So this, for example, is the method that was used by Matt Choptuick when he discovered critical gravitational collapse. Okay, so first of all, there are all sorts of situations one can look at in GR, but as with the old joke about the spherical cow, the easiest thing is to start with spherical symmetry and see what you can get away with. Okay, so in spherical symmetry, gravity has no degrees of freedom of its own. So if you're using spherical symmetry, you better not be looking at vacuum. You're not going to find all that much interesting that way. So you need some kind of matter, and perhaps the simplest kind of matter you can think of is a scalar field. And perhaps the simplest kind of scalar field you can think of is a plain old massless minimally coupled scalar field. Okay, so spherical symmetry, scalar field, and now you come to the choice of coordinates. Well, we know that if we're going to make a black hole, it's going to be a Schwarzschild black hole. And we know that the Schwarzschild black hole looks nice and simple in coordinates that are adapted to the way we write down the metric in the simplest form. And in that case, the radius that's chosen is basically the so-called area radius, one for which, come hell or high water, the area of the two spheres of symmetry is 4 pi r squared. So that tells you what you're supposed to use for the radial coordinate. And then the time coordinate in Schwarzschild, well, that's usually chosen in Schwarzschild because it's the one that gives the time translation symmetry. Certainly in a gravitational collapse situation, you're not going to have time translation symmetry, but you can always choose a time coordinate that's going to be orthogonal to the space coordinate you've chosen, and that completes this form of the metric. Okay? So what you're doing then is to just say in spherical symmetry, we basically got these two functions of R and T, alpha and A, and we're just going to write down a collapse situation using a metric of this form. And so what we want is to find alpha and A and the scalar field phi as a function of the radial coordinates R and T. Well, the nice thing about choosing coordinates in this form is that the Einstein scalar equations become extremely simple. So in particular, this implements the notion that gravity and spherical symmetry has no degrees of freedom of its own. Because for the scalar field, what you basically get is a wave equation that looks a lot like the wave equation in plain old flat space, except that there are a couple of alphas and a's hanging around. And to find alpha and a, at any given time step, all you do is you integrate a couple of ordinary differential equations out from the origin, and you find them. So this is an extremely simple system. Okay, so now, I should mention one thing, though, about these coordinates. So what you choose for your coordinates and what you choose for your system depends on what sort of questions you want to answer. And in particular, there's one sort of drawback of these coordinates that I should point out. So let me first go back one second. So there's an innocuous looking property of this coordinate system that just comes from the fact that this a squared has to be positive. And what that means is that we are assuming that this area radius r is a spatial coordinate. Well, that sounds like a pretty innocuous assumption, except that that innocuous assumption turns out to be wrong just as soon as you form a trapped surface. So in other words, as soon as you make a black hole, this coordinate system goes bad. So if all you want to know is, does a black hole form, and what happens in the run-up to black hole formation, this coordinate system is great. If you want to know anything about what happens after a black hole forms, this coordinate system is no good. And in ADS also, we have to bear in mind that, you know, it depends on sort of what questions you want to answer. Okay, so now, we want to know, suppose you do things in ADS5. Okay, so what are we going to, you know, what's different about it? And to what extent can we get away with the same old stuff that was done in four dimensions in the asymptotically flat case? Well, you got five dimensions instead of four. In contrast to stuff in the asymptotically flat case, you have infinity, but now signals get to infinity in a finite amount of time. Furthermore, in the metric that I gave before, if you're dealing with asymptotically flat cases, then when you go to infinity, a goes to 1 and alpha goes to 1. So the metric functions behave nicely at infinity. In ADS, this quantity a goes like r to the minus 2, and this quantity alpha goes like r squared. As Franz was emphasizing earlier today, that's you know, not necessarily terrible, right? I mean, this is the behavior at infinity, but it will give rise to some slightly tricky issue, which I'll address in another slide or two. Okay, so this is a difference. But nonetheless, let's sort of take the naive notion that we want to do things as much as possible as we did in four dimensions. So it turns out that these differences are okay, right? So you write down a metric that's of exactly the same form, except now your d omega squared is the element of the unit 3 sphere instead of the unit 2 sphere. Okay, now what about this stuff at infinity and the fact that signals can get there in a finite amount of time? Well, in principle, in the asymptotically flat case, you can do some sort of compactified coordinate and put infinity at a finite value of the coordinate. Or, in principle, you could make the radial coordinate range be so big that no interesting signal ever gets out to infinity. But you don't need to do either of those. In practice, what you usually do in the asymptotically flat case is you go ahead and you choose some maximum value of the radial coordinate. Waves will get out to that maximum value of the radial coordinate eventually, but you don't care because you know that what waves do in an asymptotically flat space-time is they propagate outward. And so you put an outgoing wave boundary condition on it and you let waves just slide off the grid and then you're fine. Okay? Well, it turns out that you can do something even simpler in the ADS case. You pick some maximum R. You know that what's going to happen in ADS is that the scalar field has got to sit basically at zero or whatever it is that's the bottom of the potential. And so you just fix phi to be equal to zero there. Essentially what you're doing is you're setting up a reflecting boundary condition, which is exactly what you're supposed to do. So you don't really care about the fact that R max is not exactly equal to R equals infinity. As Don suggested earlier, you just pick something. It works. Okay, now what about, yeah?
But haven't you, from the perspective of the what's going on in the field theory, haven't you butchered the field theory observables by doing this?
No, not really. I mean, the point is that...
I guess what I'm saying is when you calculate the asymptotic expansion of whatever field you're in, mm-hmm. It has some particular behavior.
Yeah.
And by setting phi equal to zero at some artificial R max, you change that behavior.
You can measure derivatives of the boundary.
So all that you need is to figure out sort of the limiting behavior as R goes to infinity of whatever it is that you want to find.
Let me put this another way. So for a scalar field, for example, just on some background.
Yeah.
If I want to have phi equals zero at some R equals R max. Generally, that's going to mean that I'm going to have to turn on a non-normalizable mode on the boundary and tune it just so phi equals zero at R max. And by doing that, I've changed the question that the field theory question that I'm interested in.
Yes, but only by a little bit of R max is large.
Yeah.
And you take R max larger and larger and check.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
But careful, because here you're talking about scalar field. So scalar field is unconstrained. Mm-hmm. So if you're talking about something that has more structure. You could be messing up on the physics there, which is the physics you want to extract. So, I mean, it's not necessarily enough.
Right. So I'm not necessarily recommending that one do exactly this in the case where we don't have spherical symmetry. Spherical symmetry is very special. What I am suggesting is that one can go after the low-hanging fruit first. Right. So to the extent that there are questions we want the answer to in spherical symmetry, we can get away with simple methods like this and answer those questions. To the extent that we need to depart from spherical symmetry, these old tricks might not work anymore.
But one point is that you could be messing up with it by a tiny amount, but the tiny amount might be precisely what you're trying to measure. Because it's a self-leading term in the asymptotic behavior of phi in this particular case that has to do with this, what the correspondence. So.
Well, you have to tell me what you want to calculate. Okay, and then once you've told me that, I will do a simulation, and I will vary R max, and I will see whether I get a limit as R max goes to infinity. If I don't get a limit as R max goes to infinity of the thing you want me to calculate, then my method's no good for that purpose. If I do get a limit, then the thing that I've calculated is the thing you wanted me to calculate. So that's.
Why don't you just give it the value and the scaling that you know the normalizable mode has? And that would be the natural way to match the boundary conditions. Then you have a parameter. That's the parameter, I think, which the field theory has. It's a real parameter. It tells you how to calculate observables and put it in.
Right. So that, I mean, so that certainly is a possibility, right? So for example, suppose that you know that, you know, things go, that the scalar field goes like, you know, say, r to the minus 3 at the boundary. Then in the manner suggested by Franz earlier, you could, you know, sort of multiply it by, you know, r squared, and then set that new rescale thing equal to 0 at the boundary, and that would work as well. What's that?
But then it's a parameter in your theory. I mean,
that depends on
that. I mean, more generally, in the spirit of what you're doing, you know, you can choose an R max. Mm-hmm. Setting the field to 0 is a little bit brutal. I mean, you can do asymptotic analysis to really understand the behavior of the solution you want for R larger than R max, and then you match. It's just like doing boundary layer analysis in, you know.
This is the way you would solve the differential equation. Classical limit. I mean, just do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just as an example, Pyotr Bizon has a spherically symmetric code in which he uses a compactified coordinate, in which you really can set things equal to zero at infinity, It's tricky to make those codes stable, but you know, given a lot of time and effort, he and his students managed to get that code stable, and they have a bunch of results. And so we compare, right? You know, his simulations and our simulations, and you know, we choose an R max of 20, and his R max really does go to infinity, and we basically get the same answer. So I mean, there might be things that you worry about, but one can check. Right, one can check, you know, by comparing it against other approaches. But perhaps more importantly, one can check by just varying R max and seeing whether that changes the answer. All I'm saying is, you know, try the easy methods first, and if they don't work, okay, try something harder. And if they do work, great, they work.
Just speaking from personal experience here, I've done it both ways, and I'll tell you that at least for gravity and the way that I've done it, this is painful. This is really painful. I mean, it turns out to be, at least for some problems. For the problems that I have played with, it's been much easier just to go all the way to infinity.
Because these are two different walls, so to say, and waves can reach in finite time as the same reflect. So maybe your wall has different reflection coefficient.
No, that's the whole point. In the limit as R max goes to infinity, my wall is his wall. Right, it's the same thing, I've tried it both ways too, it's really not that hard to get this way to work in spherical symmetry. I don't recommend it for anything other than spherical symmetry. Yeah.
Curious about something. So you mentioned the fall off of the alpha and the k. Mm-hmm. If you're putting boundary conditions at a finite R max, how do you actually impose the fact that your alpha and k should be falling off? R to the squared and R whatever.
Oh, you don't. So let me go back to that as well. So this is another nice thing about spherical symmetry. At any given time step, alpha and A are given by solving ordinary differential equations, which you integrate out from the origin. And their behavior at infinity is not something that you impose at all. They just happen to have the behavior at infinity as a result of what the ODEs tell you. So you don't impose anything for alpha and A, except, you know, regularity at the center, right? Because you're integrating out from the center.
So you're saying somehow the boundary conditions are coming from the field equation, somehow. I mean, that's what the 1 over r squared means for me, that the boundary conditions are the method.
Well, basically, the way the equations work in spherical symmetry is that you have a differential equation for A that involves the stress energy of the scalar field, what you find is that once you've run out of scalar field, when you're in a region where you're at vacuum, then as you go to infinity, A goes like r to the minus 2, And the other equation is basically an equation for alpha A, and there you find that when you run out of stress energy, alpha A just goes to a constant. So you get that stuff for free. It's just a property of the equations that you integrate out from zero. Okay, so it really is very simple. And I'm not recommending it for, you know, more complicated problems, but for these simple problems, it actually works. Okay, so now let me mention one issue that's perhaps a little bit more complicated. And that has to do with what's called the Courant condition. So basically the idea in just about any numerical method is you're not allowed to take too big a time step. If you take too big a time step, your code goes unstable. And roughly speaking, the idea is that in terms of proper time, the amount of proper time you go had better be smaller than the amount of proper length that you go. Okay, now in the ordinary case, right, in GR asymptotically flat, where alpha and A are of order 1, this thing basically says your time step has to be smaller than your space step. But near infinity, where alpha is basically going like r squared and A is going like r to the minus 2, this sounds like it's condemning you to take extremely tiny time steps and condemning your code to be really slow. But it isn't, because nothing says that you need to take equal spacing space steps. And in particular, especially if you want a nice big R max, it's a good idea to use unequal space steps. And if you use sufficiently large near infinity unequal space steps, you can still get a reasonable time step. Okay? So that's the sort of one added complication, you know. So basically the idea is, you know, take your plain old four-dimensional GR code, turn the two-sphere into the three-sphere, you know, all that sort of gives you a couple of different, you know, factors of two or something in various places in the equation. Other than that, doesn't really change much of anything, but use unequal space step. Otherwise, the Courant condition is going to condemn you to really slow time steps. Okay, so once you do this, what can you do? Well, you can do the same sorts of things that you do in GR, namely take, you know, some initial data, say some Gaussian wave packet that's initially ingoing, and then see what happens. And so what's going to happen is it's going to propagate inward. If its amplitude is high, then it's going to get, you know, enough mass contracted into a small enough space that it'll form a black hole. And if its amplitude is low, then you don't expect that to happen, at least at first. Although, as Gary is going to explain to us in great detail on Friday, you do eventually get something different. Okay, so let me show you a couple of little movies. So in particular, because it's a massless scalar field, the field itself doesn't really matter. All that matters is its derivatives. And it turns out that the easiest thing to evolve is to evolve the space derivative and the time derivative of the scalar field separately. So this is going to be a movie of this quantity x, which is basically the spatial derivative of the scalar field. And the idea is we're going to have a wave packet, and that wave packet is going to propagate inward and, in this case, form a black hole. Now, this is the initial data, right? It sort of looks like zero. But the thing to remember is that even more than in flat space, the scalar field falls off rapidly at infinity. So this initial data, which sort of starts out here, is extremely low amplitude. As it's going to propagate inward, it's going to get higher amplitude. And also, and this is just another property of ADS, that as things propagate inward, they get flu shifted. And so this thing is also going to have shorter wavelength. So let me go ahead and play this movie. There we go. Okay, so there's the scalar field that propagates inward. At this point, it's formed a trapped surface. Some of this steepening has to do with the blue shift that comes just from the properties of the geometry of ADS. But some of it also has to do with the fact that this coordinate system breaks down precisely where you form a horizon. And that's reflected in these things becoming extremely steep right there. Okay, so So that's all that's going on in this case. You just have an ingoing wave, it propagates inward, and it forms a black hole. Okay, so what about the case of low amplitude? So in the asymptotically flat case, a low amplitude wave comes in, and due to interference, it reflects through the origin, and then it just propagates outward, and then it's gone. Okay, ADS is different, right, because ADS acts like a box, and so things will reflect back, and that is going to be shown in this movie. Okay, so now we have this wave, and it's coming in, and now it's going to bounce in the origin, and now it's going out again. And it looks like it's gone, but it's really just, you know, very low amplitude, because that's what happens in ADS, and then it bounces off of our max, and it comes back again. And then it's going to go outward again and bounce back again. And if this were to happen enough times, eventually things would steepen and form a black hole. But for sufficiently low amplitude, you can, you know, get a whole bunch of bounces without that happening. Okay, so large amplitude waves form black holes. Small amplitude waves don't do that immediately, although, as Gary will explain to us, they do eventually. Okay, so what else can you do? Well, if you form a black hole, it's going to have an event horizon. And the size of that event horizon, essentially the mass of the black hole, is going to have some dependence on the parameters of the initial data, in particular on the amplitude of the Gaussian pulse and on its width. And so you can just look to see how things depend on those parameters. And what you get is something that I think, you know, will not particularly surprise anyone. So if I choose the amplitude small but sufficiently big that I do get a black hole, I get a black hole with a small apparent horizon. And as I crank up the amplitude, the apparent horizon gets bigger and bigger. That's just a, you know, more amplitude means more mass means a bigger black hole. Okay, what about the dependence on the width? Well, this sort of surprised us at first, but it turns out that it's most of it can be understood analytically. So if you take a look at the size of the apparent horizon versus the width, you get something that basically looks like this. And this part of the curve you can actually get in the following way. So imagine that you have a Gaussian pulse of a scalar field, and you fix the amplitude, but you're going to vary the width. Well, the amplitude, So when you figure out the total mass, you're basically going to be integrating over the width. But the energy density goes like the spatial derivative squared. Okay, so the smaller the width, you have a smaller region to integrate over, but you have a bigger derivative squared, and so smaller width basically gives you a bigger size of the apparent horizon. But now, once you make the width big enough of order the ADS length, all of a sudden you're sort of sampling things at bigger length, and this makes sort of bigger contribution. And in fact, if you sort of analytically expand the formula in sort of powers of the width of the Gaussian, you can find an analytic curve that fits most of this stuff pretty well. And then after this, you have sort of other questions about how much of the initial mass actually gets incorporated into the black hole. But although this curve, you know, sort of might look a little bit odd at the beginning, in fact, you can mostly understand what's going on just analytically. Okay, so what else do we want to know? Well, you can look at the time at which the black hole forms. And here you can sort of look at time as a function of amplitude. And sure enough, you make bigger black holes and they form sooner. And this also is something that is, in some sense, quite intuitively clear. Basically, the idea is that if you have a bigger mass for a given size of the black hole, it's already closer to forming an apparent horizon, just has to shrink a little bit until it finally does. And so the bigger the amplitude, therefore, the less the thing has to shrink before it forms an apparent horizon. And so bigger amplitudes mean that it takes a smaller amount of time to form the apparent horizon. And in fact, if you think about sort of how much time it's going to take, what you find is that you can account for this curve surprisingly well just using plain old geometric optics. So remember that in geometric optics, short wavelength things propagate along null geodesics. Well, this wave packet doesn't necessarily start out short wavelength, but because of the blue shift that comes with the fact that things ingoing in ADS get extremely blue shifted, you find that fairly soon it becomes quite short wavelength, and then it propagates very well using geometric optics. And you can actually account for most of this stuff analytically as well. Okay, so now let's sort of consider other questions. So what I've talked about so far is ADS in global coordinates, and this is the only stuff in those published papers so far. So what I'm going to talk about now is work in progress. So the problem with ADS in global coordinates, as Franz was mentioning earlier, is that it corresponds to a conformal field theory that lives on S3, right? In some sense, you'd rather have a conformal field theory that lives on R3. And so you can do that by doing a Poincaré patch. So this is basically a set of coordinates that covers a part of ADS. And for our purposes, the point is that you can write the metric in almost exactly the same form, except now instead of the three-sphere metric, you have the plain old flat Euclidean three-space metric. Okay, but you pay a price for this, and the price is that in ADS, this metric function alpha now goes like R over L, and this metric function A goes like L over R. And so what that means is that in addition to the issue of how do things behave in infinity and what do we do about that, there's also the issue of how do things behave at the origin and what do we do about that. In particular, it sort of looks like these metric functions are singular at R equals 0. And they are, not because the space-time is doing anything bad, but in some sense because the coordinates are doing something bad. Roughly speaking, in the Poincaré patch, what's going on is that R equals 0 is really a null surface. And for this sort of slicing, the only R equals 0 that you actually have access to is sort of the point at the end of the null surface, which doesn't change as the slices go up. Okay, so this is why these coordinates look bad. But they look bad only because they're really acting like polar coordinates in plain old flat space are acting, right? This R is sort of like a radius, and T is a little bit like an angle. Okay, so you might think this is the end of the road for the naive approach, right? We can't just, you know, use this coordinate system. But it turns out that you still can, more or less. And basically use another sort of old idea in numerical relativity that usually goes under the name of the puncture method. Namely, what you do is you write the actual metric coordinates as whatever values they had in ADS times some other function. Okay, now these functions f and g are nice and well behaved, and indeed equal to 1 at r equals 0. And now you just rewrite all the equations in terms of f and g. And now you actually have an added bonus that the scalar field and indeed all the metric functions just don't evolve at R equals 0 at all. Okay? And so what you use for boundary conditions at infinity is just exactly what you did before. And what you use as boundary conditions at 0 is things just stay whatever they were at the beginning. Okay, so that works, but this is still a work in progress. So I don't really have results to show you for that, but it won't be long. Okay, now I want to move on to the question of how do you handle a scalar field with a potential, right? So the idea is that a free scalar field is certainly something you can use, but there are certain sort of natural potentials that come from string theory that the scalar field might have. And in particular, you might think of the scalar field as something that's actually giving rise to the ADS cosmological constant because it's sitting at the bottom of a potential that has the particular value to give the cosmological constant. when you do that, you find that perturbing the scalar field around that value, you can either have, so the derivative of the potential has to be zero, but the second derivative can be either positive or negative, which means that you can effectively have either a positive m squared or a negative m squared. Well, negative m squared sounds terrible, but it turns out that in ADS it's okay as long as it's not too negative. So in particular, in this case, you can still use more or less the same variables, except you want to use the scalar field itself rather than its spatial derivative as one of the variables. And we're sort of in the process of doing evolutions of these things. And one of the questions we want to ask has to do with critical gravitational collapse. In particular, in flat space, there is, for a massless scalar field, what's called type 2 critical gravitational collapse, where the black holes that you form at the threshold are arbitrarily small. But for a massive scalar field, you can get, in addition to that, what's called type 1 gravitational collapse, where at the threshold you have a mass gap. And so we want to know whether that occurs in ADS as well. But this is also a lot of work in progress. Okay, so basically, to conclude, I claim that even in ADS, the old methods, with a few tweaks, are pretty effective, provided that you're willing to look at sort of the simplest problems. And also, it looks like numerics is starting to tell us a few things about ADS collapse, as we heard not just in this talk, but in Franz's talk, and we'll hear in more talks during this conference. But I also want to emphasize that the type of numerical methods needed depend on what questions are being asked. And so in particular, it might not be a bad idea to see if one could make a list of, you know, what are the sort of simplest problems. In other words, what problems can be addressed using just spherical symmetry, and sort of do those quickly. And also questions like, you know, what sorts of things do we need to know? Are we okay to stop, you know, when a black hole forms, or do we need to be able to follow the evolution after a black hole forms? And that will also determine what sorts of coordinates are used. And, you know, what sorts of things do we want to evaluate? Do we want to know, you know, things like what is the black hole mass, or do we want to know detailed stuff like what happens to the waves as they propagate out to infinity? So depending on, you know, all of this stuff about what exactly do we want to know, that's going to determine a lot about what kinds of numerical methods do we use. But the basic, you know, sort of take-home message is, you know, we ought to use the simplest methods we can get away with, and what we can get away with depends on what we want to know. Okay, so that's basically it. Thank you.
Well, we have plenty of time for questions.
Okay. So you select the simplest thing possible, the lowest spending fruit.
Yes.
And I want to say that I found even a lower pending fruit.
Okay.
Which was the collapse of elastic membrane. And then you don't have to solve Einstein equation because it's obvious what the metric above is and what the metric below.
Yes, right.
You only have to solve equation of motion. And that is easy to do, and everybody knows how to do it. Why I'm telling it, because in this particular problem, the metric outside is just black, static black hole ADS metric. So the observer which measured TMU just see static TMU. Uh-huh. However, the observer who measures TMU correlator, the two-point observer, so to say, they send the signal, and the signal can go down and go ahead of the falling membrane and tell that there is a piece of space where metric is different. And so the two-point correlation functions deviate from fermion.
Mm-hmm.
A single one dot. So you can also calculate two-point functions. Yes? The two-point functions will have interesting relaxation, even if the one-point function is kind of trivial.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, you should definitely send me a reference. So yeah, just to sort of amplify on this, right, so Even before numerical methods, there is an even simpler method, the Israel thin shell approximation, where you basically glue together two space times, you match their metrics, and the jump in the extrinsic curvature is fixed to be the stress energy of the thin shell, and then you solve the equations of motion. Sometimes those equations need to be solved numerically as well, but even then they're only ordinary differential equations, so that's simple too. So this is also an excellent method to point out. Yeah.
Any other questions?
Yes, what about a charged black hole?
So a charged black hole is sort of a good thing to look at as well. So this can also, for example, be addressed using the method just mentioned, right? So that's probably the simplest case. So in that case, what you do is you match to, I guess it would be ADS on the inside, and then Schwarzschild, ADS, Reissner, Nordstrom, whatever, with the charge on the outside, and then again you get equations of motion for the charged shell and see what you get. For numerics, this can also be done, but remember that if you're doing this sort of numerically with a scalar field, what you need is not a real scalar field, but now a complex scalar field. So a complex scalar field can have a charge. So now things are sort of a little bit more complicated, right? So now you have a scalar field with a real part and an imaginary part. So basically two scalar fields to evolve. And now in addition to Einstein's equation, you also have Maxwell's equation and the Maxwell stress energy tensor. But it turns out that just like Einstein's equation, Maxwell's equations have no degrees of freedom in spherical symmetry. So the Maxwell potential and therefore the Maxwell field is also just given done by an integral. And basically the idea is that the electric field at any given point is just equal to the charge enclosed divided by r squared, and the charge enclosed you get by doing an integral involving a scalar field. So it's just a slightly more complicated system of equations, but it can be done by more or less the same method. I mean, you choose the same ansatz for the metric, and now your scalar field is complex rather than real, and when you do your integrals, in addition to finding the metric coefficient, you also have to use the charge density to find the Maxwell field. That's a perfectly reasonable problem and could be addressed using these methods.
In the case of a weak scalar field pulse that you said eventually forms a black hole,
Yeah. Has
that been shown numerically?
Yes. So there's a bunch of interesting work by Pyotr Bizon, which Gary's going to talk about a lot on Friday, I think. But the basic idea is the following. Suppose that you have a weak pulse of scalar field. So what it's going to do is it's going to collapse inward, right, and then reflect outward. But now it's going to hit the boundary, and it's going to go inward again, outward again, inward again, outward again, and so on. What Bizon showed is that each time it goes in and out, it acquires a sort of high frequency piece, right? The amplitude at higher wavelengths gets bigger and bigger, and this basically makes the pulse more and more concentrated until finally it eventually forms a black hole. And the nice thing about the Bizon work is that it actually has two pieces. There's a numerical piece and there's an analytic piece. So the analytic piece is basically a sort of perturbation theory calculation that shows this steepening of the pulse. And the numerical piece is sort of like one of these critical gravitational collapse things. So the idea is you tune to something that just barely doesn't collapse on the first ingoing pulse, and what you find is that it reflects off the boundary, comes back, and then makes a black hole. So now you have things that don't collapse promptly, but collapse after one bounce off the boundary. So now you tune those so that they barely don't form a black hole in the center after the first bounce, and you find that those form a black hole after the second bounce, and now you tune so you barely don't form a black hole after the second bounce, and those form a black hole after the third bounce, and so on. So there's a whole bunch of really beautiful numerical and analytical work that's gone into that, and I encourage you to look at this Vizon paper.
Also, it was already said sometime ago, I think, Paul said, from a CFT correspondence, the on the gauge side, it means if you put some excitation of some kind, we'll formalize that time infinity. Of course it does. What else can it do?
Yeah.
So the time,
right, on that screen.
The time is unknown, but the time dependence is interesting. The
yes.
result yes. is a foregone conclusion.
Right. Right. So the statement that anti-de-Sitter space global coordinates forms a black hole, field theory tells you that has to happen.
So no. You wouldn't necessarily see it in the gravity. I mean, this might be an effect you only see when you include 1 over n.
No, you have strongly interacting quantum gunk that you just put in a box, you step back, right, you say, wait an arbitrarily long time.
But the regime we use on the study, the thermal state is not a black hole.
Yeah.
The regime we use on the study is very small energy and global ADS. So the thermal state is that gas of gravitons.
Right, so the black hole will eventually evaporate. With a time that's going to be suppressed in the large end limit.
Right. So, I don't see a CFT argument that a black hole has to form as an intermediate state. It's starting to get thermalized, but you can thermalize directly to graph gas.
So here's a simple way of looking at it, I guess. Let's say that at infinitely late times, that the final state is uniform energy density.
Yeah.
Okay. So solve Einstein's equations now, in reverse. Subject to the boundary condition that your energy density is uniform, the only solution is a black hole.
Unless you have quantum effects.
Unless you have quantum effects, yes.
But this is exactly the
And the quantum effects, 1 over n is
fast. Thermal is quantum.
I think if you're saying it's classical from the quantum, theory, large n versus finite n. And we also have to distinguish microcanonical ensembles where you fix the energy from ordinary canonical ensembles where you fix the temperature. So when Don was talking about an actual canonical ensemble and a fixed temperature, indeed, what he said is correct, and fixed energy at large n, I think the black hole is always the maximum entropy configuration.
That's true.
Okay, so in that sense, you are approaching the maximum entropy configuration, and that's the thermal thing you're talking about.
And that argument is good. You say that you could go on the gravity side without even mentioning the CFT.
Sure.
Well, and also, I mean, even if one is convinced by ADS-CFT that something like this had to happen, seeing it on the GR side and seeing exactly how it happens on the GR side is extremely interesting.
It's much, much faster than you would expect from the analysis.
That's the most interesting, much faster than the formation of black holes. You mean because it's fast compared to primary?
Can you explain how you estimate that in the CFT side?
If you're going to just get an entropy-based argument, then
it's expect
an
exponential a long time.
But it's extremely strongly coupled. I mean, how do you do reliable estimates on the CFT side?
I mean, in some sense, you should expect the thermalization time to be the mean free time between collisions.
I remind that 99% of people say that experiments for producing quadrant plasma are foolish and will never succeed because the time is very long. It runs away before it can transform into a wave. People are very surprised that it actually happened quickly. Mm-hmm. It's not true, though.
Yeah, I think it is not true. I mean, it's one of those things where, in retrospect, you say, well, of course.
But before the fact, 99% of people say, of course not.
Yeah. But it also highlights one of the great utilities of holography insofar that if you don't understand something on one side, you can always look at it from the other side and you can get a nice, simple, intuitive picture. So, for example, what are the
one
side and the other.
So for example, when you ask, what are the big questions asked from the perspective of gravity, mm-hmm. for quantum field theory, and say, what are the questions there? And then translate that into gravity and then look for that.
Yeah.
If there are no other questions, maybe we should thank David again.